everyone, and welcome to another episode of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy, there's a lot of ways you can go here. Syracuse is going to win the national championship this year week?
Sure.
Is that where we're learning?
Probably. I mean, if we're taking our current win percentage, Dan, extrapolating it out, it would seem that we are en route.
We're certainly on track. Let's lay it out. No undefeated ACC team has ever missed a college football playoff. That's just facts. The ACC has never missed a college football playoff. So if we go undefeated, I mean, we're going to win the national championship, guys. Sorry.
Facts.
It is what it is. We beat Florida State. They are a multiple-time defending national champion. Ignore what the haters are saying about the Noles this year. That's a team full of stars.
And, I mean, Dan, to take a cue from some of our Facebook commenters, I would also counter you with, we, as the media and fans, we're not allowed to talk about anything but the next game. Because
that's true.
You're violating some sort of code.
Well, we know that this podcast gets piped directly into the 1963 locker room in the Carrier Dome. So I feel bad already having so be said, because we know that Eric Dungy and the turf pellets in Eric Dungy's eye and Tommy DeVito and everyone are listening to us and just getting in their own heads about how good they are. Yeah, so it's crazy. We cannot possibly discuss anything further except for the Connecticut Huskies.
Drats. Messed it up for everyone.
The worst.
You did bring up one point that I think we should start with. Obviously, Syracuse beat Florida State resoundingly, 30-7 on Saturday. SU's first win over the Noles since 1966, their first win.
Which I like that stat, because it acts like we play them all the time. We played them historically all the time.
Right.
Which false. Is not the case.
Yeah, this was our fifth straight meeting? 13, 14, 15, 16.
I'm looking 17. Up the MQ.
This is our sixth consecutive meeting, and we're now 2-10 against them all time.
Yeah, it's like, obviously we hadn't beaten them yet, and this, again, like, three straight years we've beaten, I would argue in recent history, I would argue the three most successful programs in the conference.
Yeah.
Historically, probably you have to put Miami over Tech. Clemson, over all of them, honestly.
Well, yeah.
But over Clemson and Tech, for sure. But in the last, like, decade, in, like, the modern, let's say, BCS plus college football era, probably the three most consistently successful programs in the ACC, and we've beaten them three for three in the last 3 years, which is really awesome. It's just another... obviously, Florida State's not very good. I think any team that has has an offensive line like that is going to have serious, serious issues. And I shudder to think what happens when they play Clemson later this year. But it's still a team that's littered with talent. I think their worst recruiting class in terms of the players on campus now, at least over the last 5 years, ranked like 11th. And that was this past season when they were undergoing a coaching change. Our best ranked 50th twice. So there's a lot of talent on that Florida State roster. I get there's a transitional period. It doesn't totally erase, like, the fact that at any moment Cam Akers could have broken a 90. I mean, like, he did in Virginia Tech. He broke, like, a 95-yard run. And, like, that could happen because of individual basis. And we've seen Syracuse lose games like this against that kind of differential when Syracuse outplayed, like, the Clemson game a couple years ago that we lost. Like, Clemson just made a couple more plays. They had, like, a couple talents that we just couldn't account for on every play. On Sunday, or on Saturday, we accounted for Florida State pretty much every play, aside from, like, a couple big games here and there. But Syracuse just looked like the better team completely.
Oh, 100%. And, like, we'll get into some of Bill Connolly's numbers, but if you look at, like, the post-game win expectancy, we had the same post-game win expectancy against Florida State, 99%, based on how we played, that we did against Wagner, which I think is a testament to how much Florida State's struggling, but more than that, I think it's a testament to how well Syracuse played on Saturday and how much better that scoring margin could have potentially been.
Yeah, I said it on Twitter, I think, after the game. Like, the game that most reminded me of recent Syracuse vintage was the 2009 Rutgers game, where we played a team, they were ranked, and just because of the defensive pressure, which we haven't seen, definitely not in the Babers era, we haven't seen since some of those better Schaefer defenses. Like, I want to see, have you seen a quarterback hits number for DeAndre Francois? Because it felt like he got hit 80% of the time he dropped back.
He was only hit five times. No, sorry, that's hurries, not hits. So
that just does not sound accurate at all.
Yeah, he, according to SU's numbers, he was hurried five times. He was sacked four times. So
I just want to rewatch just to count.
so that basically, I mean, I would assume that most of those hurries were hits as well. So that brings us to potentially like nine hits.
I'm generally truth with that number because it really doesn't feel like accurate for how many times. I mean, how many times did he drop back? He threw 36 passes. It felt like a lot more.
Yeah, that's only 25% of the passes. I mean, yeah,
in the backfield, it was disgusting. Especially the plays that went viral where both tackles just were completely overmatched.
Well, the other problem is the guards. As like, I don't know if you read Bud's piece today.
I did not.
Bud Elliott had a great piece in Tomahawk Nation because a lot of Noles fans were talking about afterwards, going like how did it get this bad? Like obviously, like SU's had some bad offensive lines in recent years, but like we knew how it got that bad. Noles fans were very confused as to how it got that bad that quickly. And you know, Bud kind of talked about the role of injuries, the role of some attrition, but in particular, the fact that like both tackles, I'm pretty sure, are actually guards. And that kind of created some mismatches right off the bat, and it's something that you saw us exploit right in the game's early minutes and never kind of let up.
Yeah, and it's not like I think our defensive line has some very nice players. I think Alton Robinson's a solid pass rusher. I think Slayton's obviously very good. We have like good individual talents, but this has not been a defensive line that has ever been great at getting after the quarterback through the Brian Ward era on defense here. And to see like the kind of pass rush that we were generating, even against like what is some like a bad offensive line, like there are bad offensive lines. This is a different animal, and I don't know if it was like kind of like a blood in the water situation where the guys just kind of knew they had the mismatch, so they were just going all at it. And I think we definitely dialed up more pressure than we have in the past, but it was very stark. Just like this is not a great pass rushing team. At least has not been this year, and has not been for the last, you know, 2+ years now. So unless there's like a stark change that happened this week, it was like really, really shocking.
Yeah, I mean, I think the coaches probably saw the same thing that we did watching the tape the first time, and for some of us the second time. Although I do fast forward through the defensive drives for Syracuse, so that I'm not, you know, marathoning 4-hour games again. You did see that, you know, even against Wagner, when Syracuse was able to quickly dial up pressure, quarterbacks panicked and really didn't have much time to throw. It gave our defensive backs better, you know, ability to get in position, defend passes. The more time you've given Syracuse opponents to throw this year, the better off they've done. And that goes for most teams. But I think the difference when we're dialing up pressure and when we're not for Syracuse is pretty stark. The difference here in, you know, compared to the Wagner game even, was I feel like we were getting a lot of pressure, not with special blitzes and not with different, you know, stunts and things like that, but we were getting pressure with, you know, a four-man front just bum rushing their like porous offensive line. And I don't think that fans should necessarily, you know, extrapolate that out to the rest of our season, but nonetheless, like if you look at, like, again, bring up some of Bill Connolly's numbers that were just released today, he has the first three games up now. Defensive wise, we are 12.5% success rate on blitz downs. That's fifth best in the country. Blitz down big play rate, that's 2.5%. That's 24th best in the country. And then the blitz down sack rate is 16.1%. That's 27th best in the country. All buoyed in large part by you know, the efforts on Saturday. And I think, you know, for as much attention as Babers puts on this offense, and we put on this offense, and I personally put on this offense, this defense really kept SU in a game on Saturday in the first half when they seemingly couldn't do anything right under center. No offense to Eric Dungy or Tommy DeVito, but it just wasn't working out. And this defense managed to carry them through the first half and then help energize them in the second once the offense really started getting rolling.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm just skimming through Bud's piece now that you referenced. I did not realize they have, like, guards playing tackle, and that is very apparent on the lack of, like, kick slide speed that we saw on the edge. Like, the guard and tackle are not similar positions. They don't play the same way. There are, like, obviously the fundamentals are the same, but it takes a different skill set to pass block along the edge than it does in the middle, and that was very apparent now, seeing the issues they had plugging in, like, backup guards into, like, the tackle spots when we had speed rushers on the edge. So that was very informative.
Something else interesting as I'm going through more of Bill C's numbers, overall havoc rate, 18.2%. That's 53rd. And defensive line havoc rate, 28th overall at 7.1.
Through the whole season?
So far, yes. So numbers that we really haven't seen since probably Schaefer's first year as head coach, which is not recently.
No, that's a good sign. And that's something we kind of thought we might see a little bit more of with the shifts in how we're like aligning our defense. We thought like we might be dialing up for some more speed, some more athleticism. Obviously, it hasn't been like the full bore change to the 4-2-5, but situationally it's there. And that was supposed to allow a bit more speed on the field and a little more. I mean, I think we've seen that, especially with how well the defensive backs have played this year compared to the last couple at least.
100%. And honestly, like one thing that, you know, I haven't heard anything one way or another, but as you might remember, Chris Frederick went down probably midway, maybe a little bit past in the fourth quarter with an apparent hand or wrist injury. We haven't heard anything because we won't hear anything about injuries anymore because the ACC made him completely taboo to talk about. But that's something to watch. As we get later in the week, if Frederick's practicing, if Frederick is available for media, like he's someone who I didn't think he always had the best game against Wagner, but I do think that, you know, he is one of our best defensive players. I think, you know, he did have that big pick against Florida State, obviously, that helped, you know, keep the tide in Syracuse's favor. In general, like, him being healthy is critical. I do like some of our, you know, reserve pieces there, but Frederick is one of the most experienced guys on this defense. It's worth watching his health because losing him could have a much bigger impact than people might realize.
Yeah, he was the guy who basically, he was the one part of that secondary that didn't totally collapse during the Western Michigan third quarter. He's been consistently our best cornerback. Our best cover guy, Julian Wiggum's been like raving about him for 3 weeks, and that's a pretty good indicator that he's playing well. But if you actually go and look, like he's not been the problem in the spots where we have gotten beat deep. So hopefully that is not a significant injury, because it will be pretty impactful if he's out for any extended period of time. Not that I think Trill Williams has played pretty well for a freshman in spots, and I think he would probably be the first guy to step in there. But it's not what you want. I mean, Frederick's been one of our two or three most important defensive pieces easily, and honestly probably one of like the five most important guys on the team this year so far.
Oh yeah, and like, you know, like you said, Trill's done really well. Like Afitu Melifonwu is like another guy you want to see on the field at some point, but we don't have to rush that process. I think, you know, Frederick's earned his spot as starting corner. I think at times last year, like, he performed like a top 10 to top 15 corner in the conference. Like, I don't necessarily think he can do that for a full season, but who knows? I think even if he performs like a top 20 corner in the conference for a full season, that's a major upgrade for Syracuse and something that we desperately need. Because you know what? Like, teams are going to continue to try to throw on us, and not every team has a Swiss cheese offensive line the way Florida State does.
Yeah, and his lockdown coverage abilities on the outside are why you're getting to see more playmaking from our safeties, especially Andre Sisco, who has, what, three picks now in the last 2 weeks? And those have been largely over the middle. You're not going to get that if you don't have a guy like Frederick, you know, taking a side of the field, you know, off the map for the quarterback.
Absolutely. And you know what? Like, another guy that's worth bringing up in the defense while we're dedicating these first 10 minutes or so to defensive talk, Keelan Whitner, who ended up being honored as the ACC linebacker of the week. Guy had 11 tackles, forced a fumble, was really just a very dynamic just player all across the field. His safety experience, I think, really comes in handy. He was able to help generate pressure. He was playing in coverage. He was help run stopping. Like, Whitner was very versatile. I think this is the type of role that Babers and defensive coordinator Brian Ward really envisioned for Whitner in particular, is just, you know, kind of a jack of all trades, but someone who has an ability to lock down his portion of the field. I wouldn't extrapolate out everything you saw from the Florida State game, but just Whitner's presence and how he was used successfully or unsuccessfully going forward, I think that's worth watching.
Yeah, he was very impressive. I mean, it yes, the fact that he was voted best linebacker this week, when it wasn't like a super, like, I don't think we were jumping to talk about Keelan Whitner after the game, but I imagine on the rewatch he really stands out, especially, I mean, 11 tackles is a really strong effort overall, especially given how much Florida State really struggled to get anything going on the ground. They averaged only 2.7 yards a carry. Akers was fine, but it wasn't, you know, he never really broke open one of the long ones. As long as it was 17, and that was like, you know, a meager run at midfield. It wasn't like getting them into some huge spot. Francois broke a long one, but because of how pelchable stats are attributed, he ended up with negative 3 yards as of all the just the sacks. I hate that we still do that in college football, by the way.
So bad.
One of my huge pet peeves, because it makes it impossible to actually look at the box score and judge how a running quarterback did.
CFB stats takes it out, I think.
Somewhere does. CFB stats might either them, I think college football reference might, but I can't remember. It's really frustrating either way. But it's hard to really... Obviously, the offensive line for Florida State like makes it hard to super like judge this completely, but we even got more pressure than like Virginia Tech did, and I know they were more healthy during that game, but it was just a really standout performance all around, and hopefully this is, you know, that team starting to gain a little more confidence and step up for some of these big games down the stretch, where we have now a lot of very winnable but also very losable ACC games coming up, and it's going to, like, I mean, we talked about it going into the season, but like this, the middle part of our schedule here and like the meat of the ACC Atlantic is really going to tell the story of how successful this team can be, because like basically this whole, like, Florida State might be the worst team in this division this year, and I don't think there's another team that like looks bad yet, and a lot of them, like Boston College looks better than we certainly thought. Wake Forest looks solid even though all the changes that have happened there. NC State looks like NC State. Like it's we're very lucky to North Carolina this year, and Pitt looks pretty mediocre, but then they beat Georgia Tech last week, so...
I also don't really know what to think about Georgia Tech, though.
That's very fair.
As is typical of the Coastal.
Yes. The Atlantic below Clemson actually looks like kind of like a coastally... it's very coastally.
Yeah, you have six teams that can go 6-6. And, I mean, Florida State being the least likely at this point to go 6-6.
And it's still not out of the question that they get better during the season.
Totally.
There's a lot of talent there, and like the people over there that are like calling for Willie Taggart's job already, like,
you're dumb.
Just calm down. 1 year, like, give it. You have to give it at least 2.5 before we're doing anything. It's not like he hasn't accomplished stuff in Florida and at like a relatively big time school. Oregon probably would have won 9 games last year if Justin Herbert doesn't get hurt. So it's very quick. I get the frustrations after one game, but you'd think that like a couple days later people would calm down.
I do understand. Like, I mean, in part, like, it's part of pressure, but also, like, I do understand some of the complaints about Francois in this system where he doesn't necessarily know his reads yet. If he doesn't know his reads yet, like, how little grasp does James Blackman have on this offense?
That's a very good question, because Francois, it wasn't like one of those quarterback battles that came down to like the last couple days. Like, they named Francois early enough, and we talked about it last week. He was super impressive 2 years ago in a much more complex system, a very different system. It's not like, you know, if you can play Jimbo Fisher, you can play anything, but like the dude had Heisman hype coming into last year, and obviously he got hurt in the first half against Alabama, but it wasn't like he was completely overmatched in college football and shouldn't be starting. Like, I was pretty scared of DeAndre Francois entering this game because I had seen him all of 2016 look like probably one of the 10 to 15 best quarterbacks in college football, despite being a redshirt freshman at that point who got hit so, about as much as he did on Saturday the whole season. Very, very Dungy-like amount of just completely huge shots he takes. So, yeah, it's perplexing that he hasn't been better in this system. Even if there are growing pains, you would think he would have at least more like singular big plays, and they just haven't really come.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree there. I think he's been, for everything that we know he is as a quarterback talent, it's odd that he hasn't really been able to overcome. And like, I think he gets there. I think Florida State gets there just by way of the talent on the roster. But I am surprised that they're so ill-suited for this attack right now, and like, it doesn't really look like there's a way out, which, very strange that they would be in a very similar situation to what we were in just a couple of years ago, if not worse somehow.
Yeah, it's weird to see. I mean, it's jarring to see a team like Florida State kind of hit this low. But it reminds you that it can really happen to any program. I mean, Alabama hit Alabama before Saban got there. Now, not every program has the resources to pull Nick Saban out of the NFL, but like college football, we tend to like fall into these thought patterns of like this team will be good every year and this team is hopeless. But like, we just saw Kansas win a game 55-13, and Kansas looked dead 2 weeks ago, and they might still be dead. But like, things do change in this sport. Maybe not like the full long term, because the teams that have been powers usually remain powers, and it's hard to break through. But on a year-to-year basis, or like a five-year-to-five-year basis, like, you can see ebbs and flows.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree there. I mean, look at what Syracuse used to be, and look what we are now, and look at what we might be this year, and maybe going forward, who knows. I think that talk about changes and all that, you know, brings in a good segue to talk a little bit about the offense before halftime. In particular, the fact that Eric Dungy left in the second quarter. It was after a hit to the head, but it did seem like that, at least according to Babers, Dungy, and everybody else, that it was not a concussion or any head injury related. Rather, it seemed like the pellets that are on the field, and for anyone that stepped on the dome or any dome surface knows, there's those black pellets that are on the field. Seems like one to two of those might have gotten in his eye, creating some blurry vision. His eyes got dilated to help rectify that, but as a result, he didn't come in for the second half. Dungy was 7 of 15 for 75 yards. Not necessarily an efficient start for him. You definitely saw, and I'm going to look at this on the rewatch tonight, you definitely saw an offense that had a very lackluster play calling set. Definitely wasn't calling for him to throw that much. Definitely wasn't calling for him to run that much. It was very, very confusing early on. SU still had the 6-0 lead at half, however. Tommy DeVito came in, and you know what? Like, he didn't light the world ablaze, and I think we didn't really need him to, but 11 of 16, 144 yards, one touchdown, averaged 9 yards per attempt. Very, very good game, and honestly, like, he also was smart enough, him and the coaching staff, to, like, let him ease himself into it, but let this run game, which was more efficient than the numbers might bear out, like, let them really control things. And, you know, between Markenzie Pierre, Jarvion Howard once again had another impressive performance, 5 carries for 55 yards late. Mo Neal was 19 for 75, but did have a couple really good runs to help us start off drives. Like, the running game doesn't look much, much better, but 3.9 yards per carry, like, that's a step in the right direction for the game, and that includes, like, you know, sack numbers and crap like that. So it's probably more over 4, which is really, like, when Dan and I talked about, you know, the run game in the offseason, that was what we said, is kind of, like, you can get to 4 yards a carry, that's going to make an enormous difference. So I think that's interesting, as is the receiving game. Dan, once again, you and I kind of calling this early on, that it would look much more like a kind of, you know, family affair than targeting two guys the way we've seen the last couple of years. And once again, 7 different players caught passes. Of those, 5 caught at least 2. No one caught more than 4. I'm totally fine with this.
Yeah, I was a fan of, especially when DeVito came in, because Dungy, the last 2 drives he was in, like, you could tell he was not right. The play that I pointed to was in, I think, his last drive or second to last drive. There was a 3rd and 1 where he kind of took, like, a quarterback, like, it was probably an option play, but he was, like, one of those Dungy, you know, done a keep no matter what. And he took it left, and he had a lane to turn up, like, a little early.
Did not do it.
And would have gained 6 or 7 yards without being touched. And instead, he took it all the way to the sideline and got stopped short of the first down marker. And there was a couple plays before that where, like, he just didn't look. He was playing very tentatively, which, as we all know, is not Eric Dungy by any means. That's, like, the last word I would ever use to describe him playing. And he just didn't look right. So, but whether it was the vision thing, which would make sense, honestly, based on how he was playing, plus the fact that we were not calling passes for him for a bit there.
With the shoulder nonsense, the elbow nonsense. The
shoulder stuff. Like, early on, he looked okay because he had caught that long one to Custis. That should have been a touchdown. The Custis dropped, and the pass was gorgeous. But that was before, I think, he started, like, whatever his issues were. And then as the game went on, like, he clearly just didn't have it. So putting in DeVito was the right move. And then Tommy was really good. Like, he wasn't, like, the people that were calling for, like, and I think a lot of them were sarcastic, but calling for, like, the job switch. Like, guys,
there's a lot of people out seriously calling for a job switch right now.
There were definitely
now
some serious ones. Like, Eric Dungy was putting up stupid video game numbers through 2 weeks, and also is the guy who beat Clemson last year and had us on pace to make a bowl last year before he got hurt and was really good as a freshman. Like, we've seen a lot of Eric Dungy to know he's what we can do with him.
Right.
DeVito's going to get time this year, and, you know, if Dungy's not 100%, which it sounds like where he's fine to play for UConn based on what they said today, but in the world where he wasn't 100%, I would be totally in on DeVito playing the UConn game and just keeping Dungy for Clemson, or even playing DeVito against Clemson and keeping Dungy for the games that we really need to win. It sounds like he's okay, which is good. But DeVito, like, I think that was a nice preview of what we have looking forward to next year.
Honestly, yeah. You and I have said this the last 2 years now. Like, the current offense with Dungy in charge is good, but it's not really what this offense is supposed to be. The offense with DeVito is what the offense is supposed to be, and you saw a lot of that where they finally opened up the play calling a little bit for him because we actually had a game to continue playing in and winning with him there, and the defense did its part, so he wasn't in the same scenario he was in against Western Michigan. Again, DeVito hyper-efficient, did what he had to do. He didn't take unnecessary risks. Offensive line was still not necessarily protecting him as well as we would have liked, but you know what?
He came along.
Yeah, it took a little bit, but he persevered. He didn't have the snap issues and the exchange issues that we saw in previous games where he was just getting, you know, bad snaps sent his way. It seemed good, and honestly, like, I hope that Dino makes the shift here with Jarvion Howard as the he doesn't even have to be the third down back. I just want him to be like the back inside the 20.
I would like to see Jeremy be the back inside the 20. I wouldn't mind him being like you can't make him like the like quote unquote like regular power running back because then it's too obvious. But right. I want to see him and Mo be more of the duo in terms of rushing the ball. And then I would almost rather have Strickland be the third down back on like passing situations where because he's a good pass, he's a really good pass catcher. He can break those long runs if you want to run like a draw or something, and also he has the pass blocking. But I think all three need to be heavily involved here, and I think Howard needs to start to break through to that first team because they're all very different running backs, which is nice. Like, it's not like Howard is anything really like Neal or Strickland, and those two aren't like either. So it would be nice. I think they could complement each other, and it's just a matter of finding the right situations.
Howard's a monster. I love him.
It's he looked like really, really good. And I know that it was later in the game and we had kind of broken things open, but like Florida State was trying to salvage something there. It wasn't like they were pulling their starters and whatnot. Like, I'm pretty sure he was getting work against the first team Florida State defense, and I don't think Florida State wanted to lose 30-7 when he was in there. So he looked great. I mean, 55 yards on 5 carries is all you really need to know. And then just back to DeVito, like, it definitely looked like while in the Western Michigan game we put in DeVito, we were still calling the Eric Dungy offense. Against Florida State, it looked like a different offense. And to Baber's credit, like, he has molded this thing around what Dungy can do. Dungy's a very specific player. He's not like a lot of quarterbacks. He has a very distinct style, and I think he's grown into it, and we've actually shifted it more towards his strengths this season than trying to fit him into something he might not be totally comfortable with. DeVito's very different. He can run. I think they were said after the first game, he's probably faster than Dungy, like, straight ahead. He just doesn't have the same, like fullback, like, in the open field mentality. Thank God for that, because I don't know if I could emotionally handle that for another quarterback.
I don't think anyone could.
we're learning to cope with Dungy doing it. But he's a stronger arm. He's going to make different types of throws. Definitely more of like those NFL throws, like the one to Trustis that went out
so
for one
good.
Was unbelievable on both of their accounts. So yeah, it just the arm talent is crazy. There's a reason that at that Elite 11 a couple years ago, I'm pretty sure he finished second behind Tua Tagovailoa, and I'm not saying he compared to Tua Tagovailoa, who's probably the best quarterback in college football right now, and is just like an unbelievable rare talent. But DeVito's arm is up there with pretty much everyone else in college football. And I think we're going to be very, very happy to see that down the road. But this is Eric Dungy's team for this season, as it well should be and as it will be best served to be.
100%. I think as long as Dungy can go at a 75% clip, I think it's his. I am very curious to see. I feel like the shoulder injury that popped up in the first half of the Western Michigan game is more of an issue than anyone's going to tell us about. It seems definitely feel like Dungy threw well last week, but then this week I just felt like from the get, like, obviously that thing that happened on the first drive where he like clutched at his elbow, and then from there on, like, he just didn't look like he was on necessarily. He had a couple nice throws in there, but he had a couple like lesser throws in there too. Like, I am curious about his overall health. But again, if he can go at 75% or greater, you have to take that risk at this point, because his dynamicism, you know, as a runner is very compromising to defenses. And you know, DeVito worked against Florida State. It'll probably work against UConn, and we'll get to that. But like against some of the other teams in the ACC, like that versatility is really what's going to kind of guide us through.
Yep, we're still, you know, putting the right pieces together, but I think next year will be a much different look offense, and something that, and like we've said, like I think that's what we'll see more of, what the Babers offense will look like. But I think he's done a nice job of making the, you know, kind of blending the two, the what he inherited with what he wants to do. But like we alluded to it before, I think it's nice to see some of these receivers start to separate themselves and see what their abilities were. Especially our like pet favorites on the podcast have kind of emerged, which is nice.
I mean, not to say we called any of this, because we didn't, but yeah, and again, nice to see Custis emerge over time. Nice to see Pierce start to move into a much bigger red zone threat. Strickland, you know, being a pass catcher is great. Honestly, like Nikeem Johnson is going to be an absolute monster, and I can't wait to see him like fully bloom into what he's going to turn into. Devin Butler didn't have a bad game. That swing pass to Jarvion Howard was dope. Like that, where he was just on tear, and like I didn't think he was much of a pass catching option, but that to me like said, like if he runs like that as a pass catcher, we've got some real potential on our hands here for a guy who's going to light the entire conference on fire.
Yeah, it's really exciting, and it's just great to see like different types of guys. And also, if Nikeem Johnson wants to completely steamroll a probably former blue chip.
Oh, God. That was such a nice hit.
Like, whoever saw that coming from him?
5'8", like 180, lowers his shoulder, and just knocks the guy out on his ass.
It was awesome. So cool. That and the Dungy stiff arm, the stiff arm to hell from week one, are probably the two, like, physical highlights of the season on offense for sure.
I would have to agree. All right. Now we've been going for a while, so we'll do a little halftime here quick, and then we will proceed to some UConn preview, as everybody is probably here for, hopefully.
Yes, UConn football talk. The thing that brings the people.
Gets the people going. Dan, you are up first.
All right, so it was my birthday weekend. Not a huge craft beer weekend, but I had a couple, as I'm wont to do. I'd say the biggest surprise, the two most notable ones. I was at a beer garden on Friday night, and I'm going to just destroy this name, which is very German, but it was the Braufaktum Progusta from Radeberger Gruppe, which was an amberish, kind of more of a lager, along the same lines of like a, you know, of what you'd get from like a Yingling or something, but had more like citrusy flavors. Definitely a more interesting flavor profile in general. I had a couple of those. Quite delicious. I also had a Sweet Baby Jesus from DeClaw, which was described to me as tasting like a peanut butter cup, and did taste a lot like a peanut butter cup.
Big fan of that beer.
Yeah, really good. I hadn't had it before, but I'd seen it a lot like around recently, so I figured there was a reason for that. So definitely like very silky, smooth peanut butter flavor with the chocolatey notes, but nothing like crazy. Also, like way more drinkable than it probably should be for like a pretty dark porter. Really enjoyed that. And then I also had some Kona Big Waves, which, you know, just for something drinkable. I had Heller High Watermelon from 21st Amendment. Those, you know, you can kind of find everywhere, so those are less exciting. But the Braufaktum and the Sweet Baby Jesus were probably the two highlights.
Very, very nice. Yeah, I haven't had Sweet Baby Jesus in a while. My wife's allergic to peanuts, so I try not to have too much of stuff like that in the house.
Yeah, I don't know how much like the peanuts are directly involved in the brewing process, right? But I mean, they have to be there somewhere.
Yeah, there's some beers that actually like take the allergens out, so that you can even drink it if you do have a peanut allergy.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, I don't really like to play that game.
Yeah, it's not worth the risk. There are other beers.
There are so many other beers. My weekend had a decent amount of beer. Went to a new spot for dinner over in Hermosa Beach. They had a Racer 5 around, so I figured have that. popped over to Hermosa Beach Brewing Company, a place that I'd wanted to go. Sorry, Hermosa Brewing Company. They don't have beach in the name. A place that I'd wanted to go for a while, recently opened this year. Had a Liquid Gold IPA. It was a West Coast style. It was pretty good, as well as a Peer-to-Peer, their pale ale. Both were good. Really cool spot. TVs, some board games, dogs allowed. So typical, typical just hanging out by the beach type stuff. From 11 Below Brewing in Texas, had a Negative Space milk stout that was pretty good. I'd had that in the fridge for a while. My quest for the White Oak Highlight came to an end yesterday. Went to Beer Belly in Long Beach and had it on draft. And it was very good. Glad that I finally got to try that one out.
Nice. I still have three sitting in my fridge. I also had one of those this weekend, but I didn't want to bring it up 2 weeks in a row. But I probably should, because it's really, really good.
Yes, it's still very good. Had from Mumford, had their Lightworks New England style double IPA. That was very good. And then Long Beach Beer Lab, which is, I think it opened last year in Long Beach. It was a goza called a Warning May Contain Fruit. I think it was pineapple and something else in there. But pretty light, but enjoyable at this spot, Beer Belly. They have a couple locations in L.A. I'd been to their one in Koreatown, so went to the Long Beach locale to meet up with some friends. Very, very good spot. Also had a fried chicken Cuban. And this is just diverting into food briefly. If anyone's ever in Long Beach, go to Beer Belly. Get the fried chicken Cuban, because it's really goddamn good.
That sounds like an experience.
It definitely is. Another experience, UConn football, or whatever they may be at current, since, honestly, I'm not really sure what they are.
They're better than UTEP.
They're better than UTEP. That's good, I guess. UConn is 1-2. They squeaked by Rhode Island. There is a plane going over me, so excuse the noise. But, yeah, it took pretty much the entire game to pull out a 56-49 win over URI. This after two straight blowout losses to ranked UCF and ranked Boise State. This game was a disaster for UConn. I feel like UConn fans pretty much are treating this like a loss, similar to how we did against Villanova several years back in 2014. You got Rhode Island's quarterback threw for 351 yards, four touchdowns. They ran for almost 200 yards on the ground. They pretty much did whatever they wanted. But David Pindell, a guy who I know you and I talked about it before the show, like, UConn is bad, very bad. But at the same time, Pindell does concern me just because of, you know, the type of player that Syracuse has typically struggled against. Pindell was 20-27 for 308 yards and four touchdowns. Against Rhode Island, he also had 26 carries for 137 yards and another two scores on the ground. So despite the fact that UConn is bad, despite the fact that UConn's defense is very bad, apparently, Pindell's pretty good. I mean, those were a lot of yards. It's, 445, six scores. Like, this is not exactly... This is going to be framed as a cakewalk, and I don't really think it is. I think we can still win by double digits for sure, but... I think that stopping this team is going to take maybe a little bit more than fans think, and like we're gonna have to keep a man on Pindell, and that's proved to be very, very difficult over the last like decade plus now, despite the fact that we've had numerous mobile quarterbacks at Syracuse.
Yeah, he's really the only reason that I'm like vaguely concerned, and I'm not really concerned about winning. I think we'll win the game handily. I am like vaguely concerned about him keeping this closer than it should be. His numbers are good, and I think like UConn's whole thing, like they're bad. Their stuff is all deflated because they played two of the best G5 teams out there to start the season. So I know like Bill C's numbers have UConn at 129th, and that is adjusted for opponent. And Boise State losing pretty bad to Oklahoma State probably didn't help him this weekend in that regard. But overall, like Pindell is scary and seems to have the talent to like break a game. Granted, like Boise State pretty much shut him out, but. He's flashed here and there against UCF, so I think there's a chance that this one ends up being slightly closer than it should be. But if Syracuse doesn't win by probably two or three scores, like something really, really wrong happened here. That being said, I also wouldn't be shocked if Syracuse went out and blasted them by 30 or 40 points, because like the underlying numbers are really, really bad, and they've given up so much scoring. Also, amazingly, they've only attempted one field goal, and it was 44 yards. I don't know how that works.
See, I actually buy that because if you're down by as much as they've been down for most of these games, you're just, you figure your field goal's not going to do anything if we're down 30.
That makes sense, I guess.
Yeah. Right now, Bill C's numbers project us to win by 33.6 points. We have a 97% win probability. I don't really buy either of those things.
I think we're very conditioned to be, like, cautious in these situations. Probably more cautious than we need to be. But, like, we're still Syracuse. So until we, you know, are just blasting this type of team every week, which is not the case, like, see the Western Michigan game, I'm going to be, like, I'm going to have, like, a hint of, like, you know, nervousness heading in. Not that I think we'll lose by any stretch, but I don't want to go lay an egg against them looking ahead to Clemson coming off a big emotional win. Like,
no, I mean, this seems like exactly the type of thing a Schaefer team would do. This is even a thing an early Marone team would do, is lay that sort of egg. I've got us an early – we'll expand upon predictions later. I'd say if Dungy plays, give me 49-27. And if DeVito starts, give me 42-24.
I'm going to go on the assumption that Dungy's playing because it seems like they're not even really entertaining the question,
right,
which should be gamesmanship. But, like, I don't know. I feel like everything was confident enough in him playing versus, like, oh, we'll see. I'm going to take Syracuse. I'll go 49-17.
All right. Yeah, I mean, I think this defense is better. It's shown itself to be better. I haven't looked at UConn's numbers in terms of sacks allowed. If we can generate a lot of pressure against them, I don't really think flushing Pindell out of the pocket's a good idea. Like, as a rule, we definitely have to keep him contained and get the sack. But in general, like, yeah, I think that this is classically, like, this is what a vintage Syracuse team would do, is look past UConn and route to a new national, you know, kickoff against Clemson. I think this team, hopefully not. So I don't think, though, that the defense is going to look as good as it did last week.
So you want to see, here's something funny. I have their profile open for Bill C. I don't know if his numbers are wrong. Mm. They could be. He has a 0.0% sack rate for UConn. So if that is accurate, that means that they have not been sacked yet, which I can't imagine is accurate.
Hmm. This is the part where I pull up CFB stats.
I guess it's possible, like, but
it's possible.
But they've lost so. I mean, they've lost
so, so definitively
in two games, and then needed a last minute or 2 minute touchdown to beat an FCS team. Like, I have to imagine there were some sacks involved.
There was apparently one sack.
Huh.
UConn has been sacked once in three games, and it was only for a 3 yard loss. They're one of the least sacked teams in the country.
Oh, well, that's interesting. So, like, it sounds like it's somewhere in the middle. Like, Bill C has zero sacks, CFB sacks is one. I can't imagine then that they've been sacked a lot. So, something. I mean, it's bizarre. That's a strange number.
I'm gonna say that Bill's numbers might have just overlooked the one sack because it was in garbage time, so it didn't matter.
Oh, that's possible. I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
So that's pretty weird.
You got a quarterback that's that mobile, no matter how bad your offensive line might be. I mean, we can attest to that. Like, you can find a way to avoid sacks if your quarterback knows how to get away from people.
Yes, granted, I think our sack rate's not great, but that's because we're at 80th, we're 6.7%. But some of that was, like, DeVito got sacked a couple times in the Western Michigan game in a short period of time.
We run the ball more than we used to.
That's true. Yeah, we've run the ball a lot. We ran the ball, like, last two games, we've run the ball, like, 50-something times each, right?
Yeah, I mean, I love the balance. I didn't love the balance in the first half this past week just because I felt like it was, like we were missing easy third down. Like, I mean, those three straight run plays, the exact same play from the one, was giving me shades of Greg Robinson for a sec the first go around, and like, I'm gonna watch it again tonight and I'm sure I'm gonna have some more things to say about it, but I was terrified for a sec.
That was so infuriating. Just like, that was also when it was like still 3-0 or 6-0.
Yeah,
like there was just so little creativity in what we were doing there, and I was getting really annoyed with Babers. For, you know, it happens here, there, and there. I'm a big fan of Babers, but there have been times where his play calling hasn't been great. through the couple of years now. But man, like it was so, I just could not fathom why you run the exact same play three times in a row there. I just watched the Seattle Seahawks punt the ball about 20 yards. That was really awful. No, it was just like, just such, it doesn't make any sense why in the offense we run, why you would just pack the line in on a, you know, a draw line package like that and put no wrinkles in, no throwback play, nothing. And also then, like, for what, two or three red zone possessions, didn't try to spread them out for one play. Like, I get having a goal line package, I have no problem with that, but I think it should be a wrinkle. I hate just going to that by, as, like, the only way you're going to score inside the five when, overall, like, you're a spread offense. Like, you should be able to at least attempt both. So that really frustrated me. I'm glad we stopped doing it and, you know, didn't really have a problem scoring the rest of the game. But that was really, really annoying and didn't like any part of that early on.
Well, I do think in general, like, we've proven since Babers arrived, at least, that the only way we know how to score inside the five is, you know, via QB sneak. I think we've had one every game now. We've had a QB sneak touchdown, and that's fine, but most of them have been from within the five, and it's pretty much the only way we know how to get the ball, you know, over the goal line. Like, even DeVito did it, and the fact that he didn't inspire the same fear that Dungy does probably says a lot about Dungy's play style. Also brought one of my favorite moments of Saturday when Syracuse originally tweeted out the graphic congratulating Tommy, and then a picture of Eric Dungy came up at the end of the video. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Dan, for flagging that.
I laughed very hard at that because I saw it immediately, and I watched it like four times to make sure I wasn't like going crazy. It was so perfect.
So many people picked up that tweet.
The second part of the graphic was DeVito, so like you didn't watch your GIF once when you published it?
It's just so SU it hurts. But yeah, the one thing that we started, I feel like, trying last year and have definitely had success on at least twice now this year is the quick kind of like 3-yard Ravian Pierce pop pass to score. We waited a very long time to use play action in that game on Saturday, and I didn't understand why, especially when we were close. Pierce is the perfect weapon there, and I really hope we see more of that because, yeah, he's the type of guy who he's going to excel when you use him in that fashion of create a quick mismatch. He's bigger than most of the linebackers. He's quicker than all the defensive linemen. Like, just have him quickly leap out, do a quick screen right behind the line, and you're in.
Yeah, I mean, when you have Jamal Custis and Ravian Pierce and the ghost of Devin Butler, like, you have options for red zone passing. And Taj Harris, who sits too, like, who is not in the team. We have options there. It's not all 5'8 guys. So, yeah, you hope. And then, obviously, you even have the running backs who are pretty adept pass catchers. Like, we should be able to figure this out. And also, let's start to see maybe some Jarvion Howard in these short yard situations and not just Mo Neal, who I think Mo, for his size, has done a decent job. But
he's improved a hell of a lot.
Yes. But, like, Jarvion Howard with a Chris Elmore lead block is a lot of man to keep out of the end zone. So I support that being a look that we see going forward. And Dungy, obviously. Like, it's not a bad option when you have Dungy, who's really big quarterback. Like, I think it's a fine option. I don't think it needs to be, like, our only... We need to find other ways to get the ball in the end zone from inside the five. It's not going to work every single time because, like, we're just way too predictable down there, I think.
I completely agree. I mean, give it to Pierre. Give it to Howard. I'm looking at SU's rushing numbers now. Dungy's still first, 277 yards, 7.9 average. Neal's second, 230 yards, 4.0 average. Not great, but to be honest, I think a lot of it is, like, he's also become much more dependable on third down, and he's been in a lot of short yard situations and, like, killing out the clock situations, so that probably kills the average a little bit. Jarvion Howard, 18 carries, 124 yards. I know some of that's garbage time. Give this man the football.
Yeah, it's... I totally agree. Like, let's just... I want to see it. We've talked about it now for a couple of weeks. Like, just really, really interested in it. Also, going back to something I brought up before, kind of backs up my inflammation. The sack rate, Dungy's only been sacked 3% of the time. It's mostly DeVito, and I imagine it was mostly DeVito in Western Michigan. I think he got sacked like a couple times in that game in a very short amount of time. But DeVito's been sacked 11.8% of the time he's dropped back. Huh. So that's not great. But I think a lot of that was like deer in headlight situation plus like the weird snap issues. I don't think he got sacked that much in Florida State, if I'm not mistaken.
Maybe once.
Yeah, so I think that should be less of an issue going forward, but Dungy's 3% is very good.
I would agree. I think he was only sacked once against Western Michigan or Wagner, and that might have been it. So, with the rest of our time, because I think we already picked UConn, I don't necessarily know if we need to go into any further detail. Sorry, people who are looking for an in-depth breakdown of UConn. I think that this will be the last week where we're kind of skating by on future opponents. I feel like we dove into Florida State a bit last week. UConn, not as much. But, you know, all these...
There's not much to know. They have a quarterback who's interesting, and they're pretty bad otherwise.
Yeah, it's a game we should win. I'm looking at Bill C's numbers in terms of upcoming games. And for those who haven't checked it out, Bill recently tweeted it about his team profiles. They're on Google Drive this year, so not as easy to access, but nonetheless, like, you'll find some interesting stuff there. Andy should, for Tuesday or Wednesday, is going to be posting something on the blog, diving into some of the bigger statistical anomalies and interesting points. So assuming that the win probabilities here are correct, SU would get to 4 wins. After the UConn game, they have a 5% chance to beat Clemson. I think that's completely fair, to be honest. And then at Pitt, 45% chance to win. That puts us at a cumulative 4.5 wins going into the bye week. But like you mentioned earlier, like, kind of the meat of this schedule is where it gets really, really interesting. We're getting a 75% chance to beat North Carolina, according to S&P+, Plus, a 48% chance to beat NC State at home. That might drift upwards. We really haven't seen enough from the Wolfpack to tell. At Wake Forest, we're getting a 42% chance. Some of that bump, or to be honest, the majority of that bump is from Wake Forest being at home. We're getting a 68% shot at Louisville. The Cardinals look very bad so far. 20% versus Notre Dame, I feel like that's low. I'd probably give us like a 30% shot to beat them.
Yeah, Notre Dame has not like, they beat Michigan, and that was impressive. But it was really like one really good half they had, and right. Then like a solid defensive performance in the second half. But I mean, they only beat Ball State by 8, and they only beat, I mean, I think Vandy's improved this year, but they only beat Vandy by 5 at home. Those are not great performances.
Not at all.
And especially when Ball State went and got blasted by Indiana this weekend. I think Indiana's fine, but they're not like a stellar team.
Indiana's,
so I don't think,
like,
Ball State's anything special.
Indiana's 23rd in S&P Plus right now.
Yeah. I know, I knew that, but I think a lot of that's blasting Ball State, who hung with Notre Dame. I don't think Ball State's a really great MAC team. I imagine they'll probably be like roughly a bowl team, maybe.
Yeah.
I think Notre Dame, I definitely think that is a closer game than what those numbers look at right now. But yeah, it's a lot of toss-ups. UNC, right now, basically, this win opens up where we need to win basically one game that's going to be a coin flip, assuming we take care of business against UNC and against UConn. And that's a really good place to be, I think.
Well, because we've lost almost all the coin flips in recent years. So even if we only won one of them this year, we'd still be going balling.
Yeah, and that's still the goal, I think. Once we get to 6 wins, assuming it happens, and I know I'm being very presumptuous, then let's start to like dream a little bigger. But let's lock down the 6 wins first. And I know we're kind of now going right back to the thing we made fun of earlier in the podcast, where people were like focused on the next opponent. I'm fine like navel-gazing a little bit, and we brought up like the numbers. I think right now, if the person that was in the comments of Bill C's S&P post, we have a better percent chance at 9 wins than 5 wins, which is awesome.
I saw that. And I saw the fact that we have like a 92% chance to go bowling. We have like a 48 or 49% chance to win 7 games or more.
Yeah, these are all really cool things. I think I'm still a little skeptical about how much more than this we're going to get, just because we have this recent history of like just not winning these coin flip games, at least since the 2013 season.
Right.
So hopefully that will not be the case and this is a different season. But even if it's not a different season, 6 wins is right in our grasp here. And we should be able to beat one of at Pitt, NC State, at Wake Forest, Louisville, toss in Notre Dame, at BC. Like, one of those games, we have to be able to win one of those 5. Like, otherwise, it's a complete calamity again, like, season collapse. And not that we aren't very accustomed to that, but, like,
yeah, prefer
I
now.
Have some optimism that something will change this season and we'll be able to pull out one of those, plus UNC, plus UConn.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think, to end the schedule talk, at least, If I'm ranking the games in order of sure losses, Clemson number one, BC number two, to be honest.
Yeah, they've definitely been the second best team so far on this slate. Plus, it's on the road. They just seem very content in doing what they do. Obviously, they haven't played anyone super impressive yet, but winning at Wake Forest is a pretty good win. Like, Wake's looked quite good, so I agree there. They haven't been, like, super tested, but I think they've done everything you could possibly ask of them so far.
Yeah, I think it's, yeah, one Clemson, two BC, because they've been terrifying, three Notre Dame, four Wake. I think tie for five is Louisville, NC State, Pitt, in some order.
I think
Louisville really sucks this year, to be honest, and it's exactly what you and I said during the offseason.
They might really suck, and they still scare me enough.
Right.
Juwan Pass, like, still scares me, and I know he hasn't been great, but...
He also didn't even really play on Saturday.
Yeah.
And might not at all anymore.
There's enough talent there, plus they have the dual-threat quarterback who's backing him up, whose name escapes me.
He was actually pretty good.
Yeah,
and
so...
And they still only beat Western Kentucky by three.
Yes. Louisville scares me stylistically, even though they're the worst of those three teams. I'd say I probably think Pitt is the most likely win, even though they're on the road. NC State, I think, is just competent enough where it's going to be tough. And Louisville, they're not competent, but they're talented. Although we just saw us beat Florida State. So any of those three, like, could be a win, but none of them would surprise me as a loss either, unfortunately. But, you know, if we hang with Clemson in 2 weeks, and then, you know, we'll have a chance to knock off Pitt, and we'll be knocking on the door. So we'll see.
Agreed.
If we hang with Clemson and it's like a legitimately competitive game,
all bets are off.
Yeah, then we're really looking at something, I think, not to get too ahead of ourselves.
Fair. One other reason why not to get too ahead of ourselves, and again, Andy's going to dive into this stat a little bit more, and one you and I talked about earlier before the podcast. Syracuse so far, their average field position for starting drives, the 43.9 yard line. That is best in the country. That is in part a product of Western Michigan and Wagner endorsing the same stupid strategy of just kicking
Western Michigan having a bad punter and Wagner getting blocked into the end zone.
Well, but it's also the fact that they just decided, oh, we're not going to kick to Sean Riley. We're just going to kick to one of the other ridiculously fast guys that's on the front line in front of him. And that guy's going to proceed to run it back 20 yards.
I don't know if the onside kicks get counted out. I assume they do.
No, but I think those are just starting drives.
Do they count as Strickland's had two of, like, the best onside kick returns I can remember.
Yeah, just a clean catch and run 25 yards.
Right, like, he gets a head of steam, he catches the ball and just rips it for, like, 15 to 20 yards unscathed, which is awesome. And I really hope he returns one of those this year.
Yeah, I think he will. Hopefully we're up by enough to make that happen. But yes, I don't think that's necessarily sustainable to have that sort of starting field position. It's also helped nullify the fact that SU's offense is significantly less efficient this year than they were last year. Garbage time's taken out of most of that. So it's not just like penalizing us for, you know, taking three plays to pick up first downs or turning it over or whatever. Like, we're 77 in terms of efficiency this year. We were 62nd in terms of efficiency last year, and that's accounting for the last three games when, like, for two and a half of those, we were really bad on offense. So I do think those two things are kind of evening one another out. If we were operating at last year's efficiency and had this year's field position, I think we'd really be, you know, we'd really have something on our hands. I think that's just something to watch. I'm not going to say that it's a reason why we're not going bowling or whatever, but I think it's something to watch in terms of how this team progresses and if this team starts to fall apart based on that alone.
I'm not too worried about it yet. I think the games have been weird enough where it's hard to get a great sense. Like, we haven't played a really normal game yet.
No.
We played the bizarre-ass Western Michigan game. We played an FCS opponent, and then we played Florida State where our quarterback switch was made in the late second quarter, and, like, we found ourselves after a bizarre first half. So we haven't played like a maybe this team just won't play any normal football games, but there hasn't been like a just what you expect from a, you know, first to fourth quarter standpoint of a any kind of a college game. So I'm not going to worry too much about that yet, but it's still
something.
Worth
old, yeah, yeah. Do you think we end up what if we end up with like the first ever like dumb season? Because like
every game is at least it'd be interesting. Like, we'll have something to talk about every week.
Well, because we had Because, like, the Western Michigan game ended up being a dumb game because it was in the second half. Florida State, you and I were talking about it in the first half, was on track to be a whole new classification of dumb game. And then somehow turned into a great game. And no longer needed the dumb game classification. But, like, if every game but the Wagner game has a dumb game half, I feel like that's a new record.
I think in the offseason we need to explore this more fully.
The dumb game theory.
Because the 2010 and 2012 seasons, both great seasons in recent Syracuse history, had plenty of dumb games. So I don't know that they were full dumb seasons, but I think they were skewed towards dumb more often than not.
I honestly think, as much as I love Marone, that Marone was just like a magnet for dumb games.
I mean, he coaches Blake Bortles, so...
But, like, the team wasn't talented enough to... Like the team was always well-coached, but it wasn't always talented enough to take advantage of that. And that's how you get a dumb game.
It's... The Marone seasons were adventure. Even 2011, like, had... Like, the way we finished the season, there were definitely some dumb laws. Like, the Pitt game was, like, maybe the dumbest game we've had.
And at least it ranks up there highly. The Rutgers game.
Yes.
Was the epitome of dumb games.
And the 09 Louisville game. The Marone era just was so many dumb games.
Most of the losses.
The Schaefer era, far less so, because there's so many bad losses.
Schaefer's dumb games were actually mostly wins. But, like, Marone's were almost exclusively losses.
Yeah. Like, was it 2012 where, like, we had, like, three or four losses by, like, single-digit point total? Like,
yeah.
Digits from going to a bowl.
Yeah, we were very close to going to a bowl game.
The Minnesota game. God, Marone's tenure was bizarre.
Go Jags.
And he finished exactly 25 and 25, if I'm not mistaken.
He did.
And now he is coaching Blake Bortles to...
and he's Super Bowl-winning Jacksonville Jaguars.
Wins in New England. Well, no, they were in Jacksonville this weekend. But almost beat the Patriots in the AFC Championship last year. And Bortles threw for, like, damn near 400 yards this weekend.
I just hope you're ready for the 14-2 Jacksonville Jaguars to win the Super Bowl.
Ready? I'm fully supporting it if the Packers don't. The Jags are easily my number two team right now.
The Jags have always been my number two team, and I have photos to prove it of me in a Mark Brunell jersey from when I was a kid. But let me tell you, like, when the Jags win the Super Bowl, how much money does Jerry Jones offer Doug Marone, and how much does Doug laugh in his face and say no?
Doug will not leave Tom Coughlin.
No,
there is no chance of that happening.
And he won't go to Dallas.
And Shad Khan will just give him what he wants. Like, Shad Khan has to be thrilled.
Doug Marone's going to be the emperor of Dubai.
Doug Marone is, like, legitimately, it's hard to argue against him being a top 10 NFL coach right now. Probably, like, closer to, I'm not going to commit to top 5, but he's probably in the 5 to 10 range pretty solidly.
I don't know how you could doubt it, to be honest. Like,
who do you take ahead of Doug Marone? I know we're just venturing off into, like, crazy territory now at the end of this podcast, but whatever. We're going to finish it up soon. We already talked about UConn. Like, it's Belichick. It's, like...
I mean, I really wouldn't take too many coaches over.
The problem is, like, there's enough questions about, like, the Saints have looked bad this year so far. So, like, Sean Payton, I don't know if you're... Like, he's probably deserves to be up there still based on last season and the Super Bowl. But I don't know. Like... I'm going to pull up the list of NFL coaches. I just want to see, like, who you could even make an argument is better than Doug Marone right now.
Belichick's the only coach I would definitively take. I think Peterson's made enough random decisions. I think Carroll's on the way down. Atlanta speaks for itself with what's his
face. I think you'd make an argument for John Harbaugh, although it's not a great argument.
I don't buy it.
I think you make an argument for...
Tomlin,
even though it's not definitive. Andy Reid, McVay.
I feel like Reid's Philadelphia tenure blocks out the Chiefs' tenure.
Well, his like late season tenure, yeah. But he did a lot of winning there.
He did.
McVay, I think, is fair. He's been very good. Belichick, Peyton, going down the list. Tomlin.
That's the list. The NFL has a lot of seven. Shitty coaches.
Yes, there are seven coaches who you could, and Carroll. I'll put Carroll in there. You could still make the argument. There are 8 coaches total that you could make a cogent argument are better than Doug Marone. And I'm not saying that they all are better than Doug Marone. I'm saying you could only really list 8, and it won't be ridiculous.
I'd put him
Doug Peterson. Doug Peterson should be in there. That's 9.
I would honestly put I would put Doug fourth at worst. Not even kidding.
It's not crazy. Like, it's really not. He's done, the Jazz were so bad for so long, and he's doing it, and like, I think there's a chance that Bortles is like not as bad as a lot of people think. And it's just not the obvious why, but still, it's not like he's a superstar quarterback. And he has a great defense and a good enough running game, and they just get it done in big games offensively, weirdly. And it's strange how he's made it happen, but I think this year he's kind of proving it wasn't a fluke last season.
Yeah, I'm glad we had this foray into Troy Nunes and Absolute Jags Cast, because this is,
I don't know how we got here.
We started talking
about the last 25 minutes of this podcast.
Started talking about dumb games and then just ended up talking about the Jags.
Yes.
I think we're gonna have to talk about the Jags every week until the Jags lose.
Oh, I'm fine dedicating like 5 minutes to the Jags just to keep on adding just ridiculous segments to this podcast that service a very small fraction of our listener base.
After we got the hate comments last week, we kind of just want to double down now.
Can we call this the cringeworthy Jaguar segment?
Yeah, that's fine.
Just plug it in right behind the beer.
Yeah, just plug it right behind the beer. Just have a whole. I'll spin off all the episodes into like assholes talk about the Jags. Like the special edition. I'll do the box set when the Jags win the Super Bowl. You'll get a commercial out of it.
Doug Marone is an absolute majaction.
Christ.
Producer Lewis just is sitting next to me and just looked at me with such disdain.
Lewis
is shaking his head repeatedly.
Lewis, hope you've got some Photoshop skills, because we're getting Doug Marone in a magician's hat.
We have to hit up Andy on Slack right
Jaguar
now.
Jaguar boss. Oh, Christ. Anyway, this podcast is done. That was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Troy Nunes and Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. And go Orange.
Go Orange.